morning. Linda, I'm not going to August either.
Good morning, members, and thank you for being here. I call to order the Committee on Budget and Appropriations with a quorum present.
And I call to order the Committee on Housing and Planning, noting the presence of a quorum.
All right, we do have three compromise of claim items for budget only. And for the record, my dear.
Gloria Alessio, Deputy County Attorney. The first matter I believe that's on the agenda is the compromise for the Medicaid drugs, the Medicaid case.
Yes.
The board back in 2003 authorized the retention of a firm. It's called Kirby McInerney. They're based in New York City, but they're also in Texas, have offices in Texas. And they commenced an action on behalf of 43 counties in New York State, and they're also working with the Attorney General's office. And they commenced actions against 35 pharmaceutical companies claiming Medicaid fraud in the pricing of generic drugs and non-generic drugs when they knew that there was going to be reimbursement by the government. They have settled a few of the claims, they won summary judgment recently. They won summary judgment with regard to only six pharmaceutical companies with regard to generic drugs, so it's only a subset, and they will be entering settlement negotiations on those cases fairly soon. But currently what's before the board are three settlements that we're asking the board to approve. One is with Day Pharmaceuticals, one is with FX, and one is with Amgen. The total amount of the settlement with Day is $6.5 million. The total amount for FX is $3 million, and the total amount for Amgen is $2.8. Out of those total aggregate numbers, the county is getting $39,680 with Day, $18,314 with FX, and $17,000 with Amgen. And that is because out of the total settlement, we are getting a net. 50% goes to the federal government, 25% goes to the state. The remaining 25% gets divided up between all of the participating counties, including New York City. And Kirby McInerney also has a retainer, which I believe is 15%, and so they net their retainer out as well. We do not pay them unless they recover monies from us. So this is the absolute net that the county will receive, which is why the number is small. It's based upon the county's purchases of the specific drug that we're talking about with the pharmacy. We have all of the printouts showing all of the county's respective shares. If the board, you know, wants to see it, I can always provide it for you. But the county's respective share for the three drugs are an aggregate of $75,000. And we're asking the board to approve this settlement, and we expect to be before the board soon seeking for additional reimbursements from other pharmaceutical companies now that the summary judgment motion has been decided.
Members? Well, just so the total claim of fraud was, I said, $8 million plus. I was adding up those numbers. It sounded somewhere around $8 or $9 million. You read off those numbers.
6.5, 3, and 3. So it's about 11.
So I have $11 million, $12 million of alleged fraud. I mean, netting out the feds, so the feds didn't do any work. The counties hired this law firm to actually do the work. The state and the feds were not directly involved. They just said, counties, you want some money, you go after them.
Yes, but the state of the Attorney General also has his own lawsuit pending, and we are deriving monies from the Attorney General's lawsuit.
Yeah,
as well.
I see articles of paper, the Attorney General, $200 million, all kinds of fraud.
And we get money from those cases.
So in addition to that, this is very specific. Some prescription drug issues or drug...
Medicaid prescription drug issues. Right now, this is for generics. They're dealing with other cases. Well, I mean, the case has been... It's a multi-district case. It's been pending in New Hampshire. I couldn't actually start to explain the nuances of this case, which is why we have outside counsel.
And I appreciate that. And on behalf of the taxpayers, listen, we recover a dollar, it's good. But, you know, if you look at it, the other side of the coin is how much of your time, the county attorney's time, our time, you know, at some point... You know, it's not cost effective, but for $75,000, I assume your office doesn't have $75,000 worth of time.
We do not. And we only pay them when we recover, so it's not an hourly,
standard rate. $12 million of fraud, it sounds like we should get a little more. But.
Yes, Mr. Wood.
Just one point to make is that the litigation subcommittee has gone through this. And one of the reasons why it's important to bring these lawsuits are not only for the financial damages, which are, I agree with Legislator Rogoski that it is minimal, but I think the deterrence effect to ensure that doesn't continue without being regressed.
Yeah, I mean, we expect the numbers to be a little bit higher since they did win summary judgment on the generic, so we should be before you soon with numbers that are higher than what I have currently, but...
All right, there are no more comments. Motion by Mr. Williams.
Second.
Second by Mr. Rogoski. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Moving on to item B10.
These are four individual cases where we're all seeking the compromise of a health care claim. JC is a DPW employee who fell in a pothole in his condominium complex, and he hurt his right rotator cuff and underwent surgery. The county spent approximately $14,500 in medical costs and wages. He sued his condo complex for settled pretrial for $25,000, alleging negligent maintenance. Plaintiff's attorney, who was Michael Taub, had disbursements in the case of $72.58, leaving a net recovery of $17,742. So the county's looking to split the recovery in three ways and accept $5,914, or approximately 40% of our lien, in satisfaction of the entire lien. This again is a case, all of these cases are cases where the county's not involved. This isn't a county employee who received medical benefits and wages, because that's a benefit for county employment, and because he's recovering from third party, we are able to recover any of our monies back, but when we spend it, we don't necessarily expect to be reimbursed for it. The second employee is MB, and MB is a DOT employee. She fell and slipped on a wet floor in Apple Farms in White Plains. She underwent shoulder replacement surgery and had several months of rehabilitation. The county expended over $97,000 in medical benefits and wages. She sued Apple Farm, and she settled pretrial for $90,000. Her attorney was Kevin Fitzpatrick. After the disbursements and the attorney's fees were reduced, the county is seeking to split the recovery in thirds and accept $29,812, which is one-third of the settlement, but 30% of the county's total lien. CC is the spouse of a retired public safety employee, and in April of 07, she was in a car accident. She was in the passenger side. Her husband was driving. They collided with a tow truck. The county expended, she was injured. The county expended over $72,000 in medical expenses on her behalf. She settled the action for $200,000. There were disbursements and attorney's fees incurred by her attorney, who was Bruce Shiner, leaving a net recovery of $116,000. And the county is looking to recover two-thirds of the total amount expended. The first $50,000, $116,000 is the net recovery. The first $50,000 of the settlement is not part of the county's lien because of the insurance law. You have to exceed basic economic loss. $50,000 is the basic economic loss. Therefore, even though we have a lien of $72,832,000, our lien amount is only $22,832. You take the first $50 off, you cannot lien that amount by the insurance law. So the total amount expended that we can recover on is $22,000. We're looking to recover $15,000, or two-thirds of our total lien. And BS, who was the last one in this set of legislation, is a DSS employee. And in August of 07, she fractured ribs and clavicle when she fell down a flight of stairs in New Rochelle. She sued. Her attorney is Clark and Clark. The county expended...
If I may, these are pretty much repetitive claims that we have. I'll just make a motion that we approve.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
We got a second one. Can you second
that? Yes, and I'd like to move
B11. They stopped you on BS.
I am okay if you want to stop me on BS.
Yeah. on B11 also.
MP and MS.
This is empty, and I'd like to make a motion to approve the settlement.
And these are similar, and
they're similar.
Litigation subcommittee.
Let me make a recommendation based on what he's reviewed at the litigation subcommittee.
But we have Mr. Rogowski just for a comment.
Just a question. They're all similar, but, individually, one might have a little more or less liability and culpability. Do we get these, after the fact it's all been settled?
Yes.
Sometimes there's a settlement, and might we have said, well, geez, that's not such a great settlement. We're out so many dollars, and the case looks pretty good. I mean, these are all subjective, but our role is at the very end.
We don't get them after the settlement. We get them right at the time that they have reached a settlement. And when one of the factors that goes into them being able to settle the case is the county's position on how much we're willing to compromise the health care claim.
Okay, so you do have a role in the settlement.
We do have a role in the settlement. And if our claim exceeds the amount of the settlement, then obviously we're going to compromise more because we can't be expected to take the lion's share of the settlement when our employee was actually injured. But we have never waived the lien in its entirety. We at least recover a third so that everybody walks away with one third, the attorney, the person who was injured, and the county.
Do you ever get them all? I mean, I know it's between the client, the attorney and the client, they obviously are the major players here, but if you look at this, do you ever say, well, gee, we really think you have a better case, you're settling for X, and we have a lot of money outstanding, and don't you want to try to settle for a large amount? I mean, do you ever play that kind of role?
We don't get involved in the merits of the case. We're not involved at all in the merits. It comes to us as a strictly financial decision to make.
Okay.
The county is a mere lienor on this. You have a lien.
We are a lienor, that's it. We don't have a separate cause of action.
But if we said no, they would settle anyway?
Well, they could.
They could.
Yeah.
Well, that you brought in, you made it sound like they ask our
they do.
Our permission or whatever.
Well, they do because it's all part of, under our health insurance, we have a lien, so we are entitled to compromise. So.
So we could exercise this. So we do need to sign off on that settlement.
We need to, not on the settlement, we need to sign off on the amount. We will have an agreement about the amount.
Okay, they can settle the case, but if we don't compromise our lien, we grab.
Yes.
It's like any lien. I mean, you can go after the person who you have the lien against.
Right.
And hopefully you collect it.
Well, I guess my question is
that the county,
it would cost you money to do that. So the county is trying to do is to say, look, this is going to be a settlement. Let's get the most that we can get out of this because we've already we had an obligation to expend those medical expenses it's pretty routine to try to get that back.
And plaintiff's attorneys always come to us on the settlements. They get us involved. They talk about their global settlements, and then they work with to try and compromise.
Right. All right, moved and seconded on both items. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed?
Thank you.
Thanks so much. We have two grant acceptance items that we're going to do jointly with housing, and then we have a guest that wants to address us regarding school taxes and proposed reform. These two LGE grant hire consultant.
The administration?
Yeah.
Terrific. It's an obstacle course, Sam.
861, 862, Ag LGE Grant Hire Consultant, and 862 Resolution, LGE Hire Consultant. Okay. Gentlemen, for the record.
State your name, tell us why you're here, and do it fast because the chairman wants to move this thing along.
Promise.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Michael Odesic, Deputy CIO.
Sam Ware, Assistant CIO for GIS.
First of all, what's LGE?
Local Government
Efficiency.
Efficiency Grant for Department of State.
I had you there for a minute.
You did, Mike saved me.
Okay, who's going to present?
I will. Okay, cool. Real quickly, we applied for a grant earlier in the year to secure money to hire a consultant to look at how we could leverage and how we could looking for opportunities to leverage our resources to build GIS capacity in local government. We had three municipalities and one school district to join us on our grant, and that the grant application was submitted, and it required an endorsing resolution from the county to support the application. we had endorsing resolutions from the three municipalities. There was a 10% matching grant from our part, which is the 3,200, and we're waiting to hear from the state. So if awarded, the money would be used to, hire consent, to conduct the study for us.
Okay, so you're asking us for approval to submit these two?
Well, we submitted it with the intent, you know, we were pushing the envelope on the timing of it. It's been submitted. The best we could do was submit a letter of with the application that this resolution was submitted to the board for approval. But we had the endorsing resolutions from the other municipalities as well, and the school district.
So we're doing catch-up?
Knock on wood, yes.
Is that just accurate?
People, as you can see, the application is submitted. I mean, this is money to exactly what we want, the cooperation of local governments, yeah, right. in this very significant matter. So I have Mr. Harkin and then...
Thanks. Yeah, this is a great program through the Department of State. We've been using them through the septic subcommittee for the county's work with the local municipalities. You know, no brainer.
Yeah, I mean, we have one of the best GIS systems in the country. It's great, it's wonderful, but I'm just trying to understand. I mean, most of our information, not all of it, is sort of online. I mean, anybody can go on. So I was just reading through the act. The bottom line is pursuing GIS development efforts, and I'm just trying to figure out, we're hiring a consultant. If the municipalities want information, they can just go online and get the information. Well, so what exactly is this developing? Because you guys develop it better than anybody.
Most of the opportunities for us to partner and the cost savings and local government are leveraging our infrastructure. Data is available. The next generation of this is leveraging our applications that can be used locally. There's absolutely no reason why local governments, particularly villages and towns, should be building this capacity.
I have absolutely no idea what that means. So just explain.
Well, we've built applications, you know, mapping applications,
right.
Fleet management kind of things. And now with web technology, people locally can leverage and use the same thing.
So like fleet management, things like that, but they need to do it site-specific for their...
It's much easier. So it's the same application, mm-hmm. just different, a little bit different data. Their data using. So one side, we're now moving in a direction where truly one size does fit all. And it's really, it's just not, it's a great place for us to be, a great space for us to be, particularly with villages and towns. Cities will build that capacity just as a course of business. It's really our great mission and role to help the villages and the towns.
And that'll just fold into your information. So then it'll all be online, everybody right. can see their information, your information, it's all...
Peter saw a couple weeks ago when we were just... areas where a couple years ago weren't even touching, but in the areas of... with fire districts. Mm-hmm. In building mapping capacity, asset mapping for them too. Now a lot of that stuff can be done online, and they don't need to build that. It's a great place for us to be.
No, just say Sam and his group have been acknowledged nationwide as just doing great work.
Anybody else, Mr. Hart?
Just to Sam's point as a follow up, was a really impressive presentation that Sam gave before the Chiefs Association on mapping. Fire hydrants and water sources in the fire districts, working in conjunction with the fire districts. So it's a great resource as we talk about leveraging the regional government. It's a wonderful asset.
And this is not related to what we're trying to do, but in the post 9/11 era, where a lot of the information, GIS information, is sensitive. What do we do as a county to protect that people don't utilize this information?
Most of the infrastructure data is not available online. The most visible data source that we've all seen over the years is aerial photography, mm-hmm. and we've worked closely since.
So there are certain.
If you look at the data that we all find on Google, like Google Maps,
right.
if you find the county building, you'll notice that it's been masked, it's been blurred, and there's 46, don't quote me on that, 46 plus or minus sites in the county that have been blurred in that, and that's because of our work with the state and the sensitive areas. And moving forward with the oblique project that's going to be flown in the fall, those same sites will be blurred, through the new photography as well. The infrastructure data, water, critical water, electrical, those aren't public data. We don't push that out publicly, but those are, again,
maybe share with the municipality.
Exactly.
That really needs
and again, mm-hmm. It's great because the infrastructure and technology now is working, so we can create an intranet application that locals can use as well. It's secure. But it speaks to the same thing I was talking about a little while ago.
Any other members?
Mr. Ryan.
Thank you. For quite a few years, I have represented the city of White Plains on this board, and over that period of time, both elected and appointed officials have talked to me about political barriers to the city being able to benefit from our GIS system development, and just how good we became as a county in this area. As I look forward now, if we were to remove, say, the political problems that made it difficult for a city to deal with a county, and have a situation where there was a willingness and an openness to benefit from what's available. I made note of the fact that the more rural areas, the towns, the villages, they may be the users on the top of the list. But for a city the size of White Plains, wouldn't it be of benefit to take advantage of what the county has to offer, the county resource package here, rather than to go off on its own and try to do something that would kind of coexist 600 yards over to the, over to the northeast of this building. It just seems to me that would be something that they would be interested in, and unless I'm missing something, maybe that's the better way to go, to cooperate with the county and benefit from what we have. But that may not be the case either. So to the experts, let me ask the question, what is the advantage to putting cities also on that list of users of RGIS?
For the record, let me say towns, villages, and the city of White Plains.
I agree.
All the other four cities. Well, it's just there's the only obstacle is one department, in the city of White Plains, and they don't really have a GIS, and the reason it hasn't grown is because of the mapping system they have is an impediment to the growth and the development of the citywide GIS. It's real easy to leverage it. It's just an administrative, but where that mapping program is in the city just needs to. And I know those folks, and for 20 years, and there's been lots of interest from the assessor, police, mm-hmm. and fire, particularly. Mm-hmm. There's been numerous studies done, but they just have not let themselves build a GIS. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. Also, you just got to have get the right people in the room, and it's real easy to move in that direction.
Well, to the committees, I think. Pete touched on it a few minutes ago. We have an opportunity, it seems like almost every week, to be discussing at this table different resources that the county has that are tremendously valuable for localities in a different type of situation where you don't have a strong regional government that has been successful in developing centralized systems that are so beneficial to the municipalities in a different place, I suppose all of the communities would be left to provide on their own for the things that they need. And this is just another really cutting-edge example of how we excel, and we have the great potential to offer the benefits of GIS to cities, towns, and villages here in Westchester.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to a point of clarification to, because I'm looking at the legislation, it does mention certain municipalities, but not others. This grant would enable you to do this implementation, the analysis and implementation plan for all of the cities, or just
these are, we're going to be kind of our prototype. These are the ones we're really going to look under the hood, and you can see here specifically that we picked a village, a town, and a city, so we could have a cross section of involved in the study. So
right.
We could go back.
But I want to make sure that all, like City of Mount Vernon, City of Yonkers, are they going to be benefiting from this program also or not?
Yeah, they certainly would in the long run. Okay. But again, you know, Yonkers has a bit, some, they've done a good job of building some of their infrastructure, and Mount Vernon has huge opportunities to become more engaged with this. So,
what does that mean?
Well,
they're not engaged now.
No, they're not. They're not.
Okay. What do I need to do to get them engaged then?
All you got to do is get a couple people at the table, the right people at the table.
All right. Well, I'll have to talk to you after
Please
this
do.
Because I want to make
Please
sure
do.
That if I'm going to support Please this legislation, do. that my city is benefiting from
yeah,
it.
No, absolutely.
Linda, just sign
why don't I write that there in the
just sign right there.
Why don't I do that? I'll just write in the City of Mount Vernon as a part of this.
Here we go.
No, I will talk to you after
yeah,
this. Sure
Please do.
Right. Okay.
Thank you. Any other members?
So move, Mr. Chair.
Second.
Moved and seconded for budget and appropriation.
And for housing and planning, I have a motion by Mr. Nona, seconded by Ms. Williams. For both committees, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Both items are therefore approved. Thank you very much. For housing and planning, we have one set of minutes. Ms. Myers, for a motion.
Yes, I have one
Thank
change.
You. Thank
housing
you.
And planning
Good
on
work.
Page
See
two,
okay.
and I'll
Thank
hand
you.
It over to you. But with that change, I move the acceptance of the meeting minutes from February 23rd.
Seconded by Mr. Rogowski. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion approved. May I have a motion to adjourn the Housing and Planning Committee?
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Harkin. Seconded by Ms. Speckman. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Housing and Planning is hereby adjourned.
We have minutes for budget and appropriations.
One
more change, the motion is in order.
So moved.
Moved by Mr. Rogowski.
Seconded
by Ms. Myers. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved.
Any
potential changes? Let us know. Okay. Mr. Williams has been gracious enough to invite a gentleman that has been doing some work regarding school taxes and the rate. The name is Derrickson Lawrence. Derrickson Lawrence.
It's here.
And company, apparently. And you're going to connect a presentation on the on that monitor, I guess?
Yes.
If possible,
yeah.
That would be great.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we can do that now.
I recognize you from your photo.
Could you just, yeah, I think you're going to need to open the board.
Yes.
You can't reach it either. I'll hold you.
Don't
stand in that
chair.
Wait.
Why not?
Who's
taller?
Marty,
you're
taller.
Marty, Sally, no.
Good God, now you step in.
Of course.
How many legislators does it take to get a screen now?
None, because the staff is far better equipped.
I'm going to move over with Bill.
Well, they're set up. The guest setup, do you want to highlight what prompted the invitation?
Sure. Let me first of all thank our guest, Mr. Derrickson Lawrence and company.
Hugh Marriott.
Hugh Marriott, basically, for this presentation. Mr. Lawrence is a part of Westchester County Homeowners Coalition. And what they've done is they've done a lot of analysis with taxes in terms of really looking at a granular level of how the taxes in various municipalities impact the overall tax picture for the County of Westchester. One of the issues I had discussed with Mr. Lawrence several months ago was, you know, that the study that was done by the Center for Tax Education in Washington, D.C., that concluded that Westchester County was the highest tax county in the nation. And for 2 years in a row, we had been up there. And we try to get a sense of, because most of those studies, you see the results. But you really don't see underneath the results what causes the conclusion. And so part of what Mr. Lawrence has done is to look at some of what causes that conclusion in Westchester County. And I thought it would be instructive for him to make a presentation to us at the Budget and Appropriations Committee so that we get a sense of this as they're going around different parts of the county with this. The study, I think, resulted now in a bill that's before the state legislature that's being considered, which is something that we might want to take up at some point under the Government Operations Division in terms of supporting. But I thought it would be instructive for him to actually give us some analysis of the school and local taxes, how they impact the county.
Thank you, Legislature Williams. I really appreciate that introduction and background. As he indicated, in the fall, we all learned from County Executive that Westchester County was the highest tax county in the nation. And that statement sort of jarred me a bit. I really wanted to get to the bottom of it to see why that was. And in doing so, we were able to unearth some disturbing trends underlying that point in terms of how we in Westchester actually came upon that distinction. So we also saw actually just this past week the results of the school board elections and saw that, you know, the run-up to it was a lot of angst, a lot of hype, a lot of sort of throw the bums out, it's tax revolt and so on. And nonetheless, 92% of those budgets passed. So what is the implication of that? Those are some of the questions we're going to try to answer as we go through the presentation to you. If you can just get through. Okay. The idea, however, is to really start with the fundamentals and looking at a way to pursue constructive dialogue and do this with empirically based information, really looking at facts, looking at numbers that you can't argue with. More importantly, putting those into some sort of context in terms of the particular cities, measuring those, and lastly, looking at a framework for solutions, both looking at it tactically and strategically. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about trends, and trends are based on data that you collect over a couple, 3, 4 years, and one event, as you had like last week, doesn't change the trend. It's a bleep, and so we need to look at that in context. That's what we're going to try to juxtapose and give you the answers, of course. We thought we would start with the city of Mount Vernon. We know the city best, that's where we're from. That's just the county homeowners coalitions. We're based out of the city of Mount Vernon, but we've got a large geographic footprint. And so when we look at that, going back to 1992, 8 years ago, we looked at where school taxes were, and this is just a view of the tax, property tax dollar, how that was spent in 1992, the apportionment. School taxes was 57% of that dollar, the county was 17%, and the city 26%. That's sort of the breakout that we had. Fast forward to 2009. And you see that number jump to 63%. And the remarkable thing here is, if you can go back to the slide again, county taxes is 17% then in 2009, 12.5%. A city, relatively the same. The point here is, just mathematically, as one portion of this pie grows, other portions, of course, get smaller.
And so the implications of that is pretty significant if those trends continue. And those are some of the issues that we're trying to grapple with as you go forward. We looked at the comparison, of course, of looking at the blue chalk county city tax rate in Burgundy and school tax, and you can see how one dwarfs the other in terms of growth as it stands. In year one is 2005, 2006, 2009, and just look at that trajectory. It gives you a sense of where those numbers are heading. 2009 in Mount Vernon in particular, that was $720. That's the tax rate per thousand. Now, we had another 8.7%. Actually, I'm not approved. It was voted down, so the number was actually 8.6%. So that number, 719, went to 763. If I have, is there a pointer here that I can use? But if you look at that chart on the right, it says 719.
Right.
Today that number is 763. So the what you have here when you look at this number from 2005 to 2009, if you can click on the next slide, that was, it went from what was a 40% growth to what is now a 53% growth. That's a huge, huge number for any municipality, any city. And so that has been significant for us. We took that chart, again, another 5 years out, and the numbers here are staggering, going up to close to $8,000 per tax, you know, the tax rate per thousand. So that's, that number is going to be significant as we go forward. We then said, let's compare this to cost of living and look at where the numbers are. In year one, that's 2005, number two here is 2006 and three. And you can see in the bottom part of it, it's the cost of living indexed. The middle part of it, the total tax rate. The lighter yellow part of it, school taxes, and you can see the divergence. We're at number four, where the CPI is close to zero, the numbers are diverging and going up in opposite directions as you go towards the latter years. So this is compelling information that certainly has to be taken to heart as you look down the road. Certainly, the county's focus is on county issues, and we understand that. But that's going to have implications for you as a county. And the point we're going to try to make here today is legislatures, all of you, are part of some local district that's certainly going to be impacted by this. So we'll look at some of the conclusions that we've drawn from that, and we'll make that as we go down through the presentation. Again, just to drive the point home, I think you all understand this. Cost drivers here are the labor rates and benefits. And again, we're comparing this to CPI. This is just, let's go back. This just looks a little more granular data, and we're comparing the cost of living index to the left. You're looking at total tax rate and school tax rate. So let's compare the cost of living index, the two reds, and you can see 2005, 10.8%, 2.8, and 6. So you can see the divergence. 2.8, where the CPI is zero, there's a 12% increase. Now that's the city of Mount Vernon. We're not saying all cities have done this, but we're saying that's one data point. If we can compare others, we will see similar trend. And we have aggregate data that points to that. So we won't go through each of them. We just want to show you what that means. So let's go to the next slide for a moment. We thought we'd look at New Rochelle and White Plains. And in looking at that, school taxes, 40% increase over the 5 years. New Rochelle, about 30%. White Plains, 26, 27%. So those numbers are going up. And again, the point I have to reiterate is,
as the growth of school taxes continue in this trend, other components of that are getting smaller. So that's what we need to look at. Let's take a look at City of Yonkers very quickly. We added City of Yonkers. Again, let's focus on the school taxes there, where we ended in that far right column, where the beige here focuses on White Plains. Yonkers here is a little under Mount Vernon by 35%. That's where that number is. Implications for Worcester County. The bottom line here is when you aggregate the three largest cities, what are we looking at? All four of those are above 53-54%. That's Worcester County. So if you take the tax dollar and you look at where the dollars are being spent, property taxes, goes to school taxes. So we know what the county's function is, the burden is. Look at where your numbers are compared to that of the school. And if you keep the trajectory on the same path, we don't have to be rocket science to get a better idea or some idea of what's actually happening and the real implication of this. So, as we have here, let's get back. Each of them maintains a number higher than 53%. And as school taxes go, the county and city taxes naturally go down. Let's scale it up a little bit. We thought, okay, that's Westchester County. Do it on a state level. And this chart shows school taxes as a percentage of property tax increase for 2008. Again, these are trends, so these are numbers going back from 2005, 2006. And again, school taxes across many of our counties, the same issue. The numbers as put by the New York State Office of Real Property Services and the Tax Foundation Organization, 63%. To put a final point to it, looking at counties of Westchester, Nassau, and Rockland, Nassau being third, Rockland being fifth, in the nation. So three of our counties have that distinction of head and shoulders above everybody else. So that's pretty significant. There's something wrong with this structure here. You know, and that's what you probably heard a lot of voters and angst over the run-up last month or so. And so this is what we've got. So what do we do about that is really the real question. How do we get away from this? Because this monstrosity, because of a budget vote last week, it didn't go away. That's still with us. More important than that, when we looked at the numbers for this year, the city of Mount Vernon voted down their budget, right? We had the action that said no. But it went from, when you vote no, you go into contingency budget, as you know. So we went from an 8.6% to vote no to 8.5%. What happened there? And so we have to ask our solve these questions. Well, the people who voted no, they really got something out, or they thought they were getting something out of it. For the folks who voted yes, we're not sure what was compelling. Well, there are two things we can assume. One is they saw that many of those districts did cut costs, did do something to appeal to the voters, to change their votes a bit. Some of them could be thinking very much the same as the voters in Mount Vernon. Even if I went in and cast a vote no, I'm still going to have the same result. So, well, what are we really accomplishing here? The trend is still, it's there. And this year, we had a CPI pulled by the state or used by the state as zero. So that's one of the reasons, right? Because if you vote no, the budgets are reflected back to the CPI for the previous year. This year's CPI certainly will be 2.7% and rising. And so we're back to 2006, 2007, 2008 data all over again. So we haven't seen the real impact of these numbers because they're going to come back. So this trend is going to continue. If we're not strong about bringing fundamental change, structural change to this process, That's really the message to you guys today. So, just a summary of findings, then we'll go through where we see the solution to be, the alternatives here. It's growing at an unsustainable rate. The numbers today pales in comparison to what will follow, considering now CPI and inflation is about to show its head again as we go forward. Clearly, by all the data we've seen, property taxes 78% above the national average. That's pretty distinctive here. And as the CPI is falling, the rates are going down. Most serious offender is property taxes. Stay on this point for a minute. Growth of spending versus growth of funding. It's not a finding. It's really an observation, per se. We know what happens, right? You have growth of spending exceeding that of growth of funding. What's the real implication of that? Well, there's a gap there that gets created. And somehow we have to try to fill that gap. And this is where we have, you take on all the revenues, you've got to go to tax levies, right? That's the only way of doing it. But you have another unique factor. If now the growth of funding gets chopped up, as we've seen here in this paradigm shift, now that gap becomes even larger. And it gets larger for those districts that are hugely dependent on those funding. And that's the real issue here now. We have an unequal playing field. It's no longer level. So this scenario refers to everybody, right, getting funding, and we know they are all exceeding that, so you have one gap. But then you have districts that are heavily dependent on that funding, and when that funding gets cut, like the city of Mount Vernon, or maybe Yonkers, or maybe Peekskill, wherever those numbers are, then that gap gets magnified. And so you have unequal territory. And so what we've found, and we've said, look, when you hear folks talking about tax cap, one size does not fit all. We can't apply the same rule to everybody. There has to be a sense of how do we measure this? And so that's one of the messages, the central themes here. Overall, we're spending more in terms of taxes and we're getting less in terms of quality of education. So the process today is ineffective, certainly unsustainable. That's really our conclusion. In speaking with Lyndon, I thought we ought to put this slide up here. Is there a role for county government? Because you guys you're not shielded from this. This is, your purview and your charter doesn't call for you to be involved in school taxes, but it has an impact. And so, if those tax trajectory continues, and I really do have some discomfort in making this kind of statement, but when you look at the numbers, if you guys did not begin to look beyond the current ages, you risk being marginalized. Because as these numbers, tax dollars, or county size, get smaller, your role really gets smaller. That's you can't get away from those numbers. Those are facts. So these are issues you have to struggle with. Each legislature does have a local base. So we're saying there is a need for you to embrace property, the tax problem, with the same level of enthusiasm as you do with the cannabis. It's part, you've got to make this part of your charter as you go forward. Because that problem isn't going to go away by itself, on its own. So what are your means to doing this? Suggested using the bully pool. Really using your strength here and your visible role in the county. The solution strategy we put together and we've seen, again looking at what the folks have done at the state level, we've seen tax reform, tax cap, circuit breakers, financial reform, we've heard it all.
and of course education reform. The first two, here, tax reform, tax cap, and circuit breakers, they both add to the budget. They add to the deficit, if you will. So those are issues that we felt, okay, they may work, but they add to the problem, so we need to look at other deals here. Financial reform, austerity budgets, shared services, administrative services functions, these are all of the things that we felt made sense to pursue. So we decided to hone in on that. Education reform as a quality of education, we thought that would be taking on too much, so we haven't really pursued that component here. But we thought a sticks and carrots approach to implement the solution would make sense as a way to halt escalating labor costs and to provide some sort of tax cap initiative. But as we said before, you know, a one-size-fits-all would not work in this particular case. So we came up with a bill, 10621, that really looked at individual district. If you voted no in your district, it would actually mean something. And so we're saying allow voters to make that cap or no cap decision at the ballot box. And austerity would mean something here. In this particular case, it would be in a inflationary time where you have CPI greater than 2.7, which it will be for next year. We're saying we'll cap it at 2% or 120% of CPI, whichever is lower. We're saying it should also bring with it the ability to freeze labor costs, because we know that's a big part of those numbers. Another component here would be improve or impose greater transparency requirement as part of that. Before we go, those 3 points here are important to understand. The law in the way it's written today, we're not going to ask when the bill passes to say, look, let's do it unilaterally. It's going to require labor or the employees to be a part of that. So it's not a unilateral force. It's working together to get it done. Sticks and carrots approach. The carrots here is dollars for shared services. And we're coming to the end of the presentation, so I'm going to speed through this.
You're testing our site, too, right?
What?
Yeah.
You're
testing our site.
Okay. I do apologize for that. I'm hoping that what I'm saying, though, is...
No,
okay. All right. The dollars for shared services, what does that mean? It allows districts that are sort of... unevenly affected by this to claw back dollars. So in the case of Mount Vernon or Yonkers or Peekskill, who have been hurt by this, they have an ability to come back and say the dollars that were cut from them, they can actually get some of that back, but they need to demonstrate that they've done something for it. So shared services, either with the municipality or with BOSES, would make sense. There are options there, there are opportunities there. Work with either one of those two, demonstrate you can do this to make it work. And so that's part of the bill. And we have the key areas, whether it's DPW, whether it's technologies, whether it's procurement. The last bill that we have here is the Taylor Statute. You've heard a lot about tribal amendment and the issues that's part of that. New York State is the only state where the terms of an agreement survives the expiration of that agreement. And so we felt it made sense to look at this and amend this bill. Yeah, and this is all part of the bills that Prentlow has put together. And it's, all we're doing here is extending the numbers. Instead of having it open base, give them 6 months to get that done. And so that's where we are with this. Prentlow has introduced this. Sandy Gaylor from Norfolk County has co-endorsed this. We're working with key senators to do the same in the Senate. And we think it's going to be a win for the district, a win for homeowners, and a win for the state. In terms of going forward,
We're asking for a resolution to support this concept. We're going to be going, we started in the city of Mount Vernon. We want to go certainly to New Rochelle and White Plains. We're here today with you guys. We believe shared services discussions should certainly go beyond what has already started in our city. And we plan to reach out to the governor's office. We felt, you know, whether it's current governor or incoming governor, who, by the way, if you saw some of his the initiatives that he is pushing forward, they are tax cap at 2%. They are looking at pension reform. They are looking at many of the things that we've already started here. So we think that this is going to continue as you go forward into the next administration, and we're looking forward to your support in helping us get it to the next level. So if you have any questions, I'll be willing to entertain them at this point.
Yes, Jim.
Where would the money from the... This is fantastic. Where would the money for the clawback dollars come from?
The funds from that would come from either the state or federal. And the issue here is, today we know it's tight time, so those numbers are not there. But with an improving economy, we thought 2 years down the line, there would be an opportunity for that. And so that would that's where the money would come from, state or federal. We also felt that it made sense to make that a competitive sort of deal, so not everybody would get that. But for those who did not win that lottery, they would have gained through consolation by already saving dollars, by consolidating. So there's a consolation in it for them as well.
And then the other thing, I mean, you base this all obviously on property tax because that's what we use currently to fund our, most of public education in this county. What role have you taken a look at income tax in the state and where we stand versus other states and what percentage of school funding is funded through income tax in other states versus New York State?
No, we have not done that analysis. We focus simply on what we saw were, was the lion's share of the growth.
Yeah, but that's
but
a
my
good,
understanding
that's a good point.
Historically is as we in this state have cut our income tax, especially in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
It just shifted more and more of the burden onto property tax. And
as a source of revenue.
Right, and one of the things that we've seen here, and I actually represent a rather well-to-do area, by and large, where the amount of state funding is so minuscule now that there's nobody even all that nervous over what happens with the state budget. We're not getting any of the money anyway.
Sure.
So it is so totally dependent on property tax, and I would love to see an analysis that might show that we'd take a look at shifting the burden back, in my opinion, to an income tax where it really belongs, but taking a look at that versus or taking a look at another source of funding. I believe Michigan has worked with cigarette taxes, but then everybody stopped smoking. But I mean, you can look at other ways in which to fund public education.
I think that's a worthy point. I mean, it has merit. There's no question we've gotten stuck with one way of doing this, and in time of crisis, we're looking at alternatives. We have to look at everything, and that certainly, has merit. Something ought to be looked at as again another alternative. But we cannot continue to see this monstrosity and do nothing. There has to be a way of looking at it.
Well, in my opinion, it becomes ridiculous that that's how you. I think it's ridiculous that one would fund any kind of social program out of property taxes.
Other members, other questions?
Jose.
Yes, sir.
Judy opened up an interesting area of discussion that I think that, you know, most of us, or at least she pointed to a time when the state had made a decision to reduce from double-digit rates the income tax in New York down to years and years of a single rate. But really, over the years, what has happened, which we're going to be asked to join support for resolutions that support different things, one of the things that we have seen is this because we do have a system that makes substantial use of taxes generated from real estate, the use by the state of what's called combined wealth ratio, where what they do is they take, they come up with a number of the amount of income in a school district that stands behind each able pupil you have. And they come up with a full value number that stands behind each able pupil unit. And they take these and they combine them in what's called a combined wealth ratio, and then they send money down to the district through a formula that plugs in the combined wealth ratio, but it's obviously an inverse relationship between the ratio and the driver that that sends the money into local schools. That driver is applied against the number that's called an aidable ceiling number. They come up with $5,000 per kid or $6,000 per kid, and the driver number is applied to that. And if you have aidable pupil units of, say, 3,500 kids, that will generate your operating aid number. So over the years, it hasn't really mattered that the state is has either collected more or less in the income tax. It has to do with the formulas that are in place that are applied to the pool of money available. And the pool of money can come from a number of different sources. So the, you know, one of the bigger questions over the years has been, do you just totally come off the residential and commercial real estate property tax piece of this and shift entirely to where the state's support through the money that it raises, a lot of it is income tax, but do you shift to a system where state support of your district comes entirely from the state? And one of the problems that you run into is that we historically have been a state of communities that have held strong to the notion of home rule and local control, and our will to provide locally for the things that we want, in this case, the things that we want for our kids. So in English, what does that mean? If the state decided and they entertained the formula change that would drive just so much per kid into a school district, would we or would we not any longer have the right to add to that to make sure that local resources were also provided? So if we chose to have an electron microscope for our kids, we would buy it. If we chose not to, we would do without. So there's a lot of different things that I think over the years have been on the table. I commend you for looking into the things that you have looked into today. I know the cities may choose to do different things by resolution. The Board of Legislators, I would just say, we need to have a really deep discussion on what the situation is and the types of things that we would be lending our support to. That I can assure you won't be a three-hour discussion some afternoon. Clearly, the thing has to be changed, but it's one of the more complex and complicated areas that you've tackled. And what Judy mentioned and kind of suggested, have even modeled it to some degree. I certainly would like to see at some point. I would never expect you guys to go home this afternoon and try to work this out. But modeling this, I think, would be extremely important for state officials, and school district people, and all of the others who want to lend their support to this, to be able to see what would or wouldn't come out of a major change in how we fund education. Because it all boils back down to the same basic question that we're faced with in all the other areas of government as well. What are the most important, what are the most essential services that we need to be providing, whether it be schools or county or village or town or city, and how do we pay for those? And you've just stumbled upon one that happens to be much larger and much more complex. And just as a final footnote, it's unfortunate that in last week's local elections for school trustee and school budgets, so few people take the time to go out and vote on what is, obviously schools are governments, and they are one of the largest, most important class that we have in New York, and so few people take the time to go out and participate.
Very shortly, we're ready to adjourn, but I have a final comment with Mr. Harkin.
I'll be very brief. I just want to thank you both for coming, and it's interesting. It doesn't matter large city, small town, south or north. I was saying to Lyndon before the meeting started that we share the distinction, our communities, of being among the only towns or cities in Westchester to vote down our school budgets. One of the school districts I represent is Katona-Lewisboro in the north of the county, and they, along with Mount Vernon, voted down the budget. And my wife is on that school board, and just grappling with these issues that you so, you know, perfectly articulated, that this is just not a sustainable system. So I think, you know, we've got a couple of challenges. One is the short term, and some of the steps that you laid out here, and I think, you know, Judy touched on what really the long term is we've got to figure out a sustainable way of funding our education system, because our property tax system is clearly not working anymore. So to whatever degree we can be partners with you in that, we're happy to. So pleasure to meet you.
Do you have a Senate bill? Is there somebody in the Senate that's picked this up?
No, not at this moment. We have spoken to key members of the Senate, and they are one person is considering initiating
sponsoring. Have you reached out to Senator Ockenheimer's office?
Yes.
Because she's the head of the education.
She was one of the people who met in Albany, and we met last week.
Well, Mr. Lawrence, Mr. Marriott, thanks so much for taking the time. We appreciate it very much. It boils down to something that began happening within the last 2 decades. It was called devolution, you know. And we sort of ignored it and continued to do the taxing and the property taxing. Things were good at that time. And if we don't have those circuit breakers to highlight and begin to prepare for what we're going through today, the future does not look too good. But I thank you very much for your presentation, gentlemen, and continue, and we hope at some point we can support your endeavor.
Well, we do appreciate your level of receptiveness to what we have to say. We do apologize for being late, and we thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Moved and seconded. All in favor? Opposed? Stand adjourned.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
A copy of the presentation.